Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Andy Boyd. Today we're talking with Barry Witham about his book, From Red Baiting to Blacklisting, The Labor Plays of Manny Fried. Barry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Andy, very much.
So hopefully your book will do something to remedy this, but Manny Fried is not a household name, even among theater aficionados. Could you kind of give us a sense of who he was and why you wanted to write a book about him?
Sure. I became interested in Manny when I was doing some research on the Federal Theater Project a couple of years ago in the WPA, and it had led my interest to a play called, I don't have the name of it. The Young Go First was the name of it. And it was a play that really critiqued the CCC programs of the WPA. And I was intrigued by that because I wondered what the critique was. Well, it turns out in the play, the critique is that the Communist Party and other agencies felt that the whole CCC program was an attempt to create a kind of shadow army and drag the United States into wars. And I found that kind of intriguing. And so I looked a little bit into this play to see what its history was. In its background, and I discovered that there were three members of the cast who were still alive. One of them was Emanuel Fried. I got in touch with Manny. We had several interviews, and I learned about the plays that he'd written while he was blacklisted. So that's where I began to investigate him.
That's such an interesting premise for a play. Is this the sort of the early 30s, third period stuff where they're calling Roosevelt a social fascist and that
right.
sort of thing?
Absolutely. 1934, yeah.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense then. And so Manny Fried is really kind of comes out of this radical moment in the 1930s, works with Elia Kazan, Martha Graham, Elmer Rice, is sort of rubbing shoulders with the group theater.
Right.
How did that period, both the politics and aesthetics of that period, shape his playwriting for the next several decades?
Well, it was so interesting because, he really bought into the kind of propaganda of the young Communist Party. He really believed it, and he became absorbed by the notion of worker power and worker rights. And he left the theater and began to become an organizer in Upper New York. He went back to Buffalo, where he worked for a while in a little theater. But he became an organizer. And the whole notion of organizing and organized labor, and the fact that he believed that the Communist Party was the only real agency that would recognize that there was a class problem in this country. And he followed that really for the rest of his life.
Right. There's that kind of myth that America is a classless society.
Right.
Yeah. And that runs really deep in American culture.
Yes, it does. And Manny tried at every turn to pop that bubble.
I like how you phrase that. So you quote Vivian Gornick in the book, and I actually happened to just a few months ago read her book, The Romance of American Communism, which talks a lot about the emotional reasons that people were drawn to the Communist Party.
Right.
What did the party mean to Manny Fried? Obviously, you know, provided a political home, a political analysis, but in terms of kind of his emotional life, what did it give him?
I think that one of the things that really intrigued him was the whole issue of race and the whole issue of organizing black labor. He has a wonderful record when he went back to begin organizing in New York of trying to get black people involved in the labor movement, because he believed that the communists were the only ones who really were interested in organizing the blacks. And even though they had many, many weird attempts to go into the South, organizing sharecroppers and others, Manny believed in the dream of that. And I think that's what really provoked his interest.
Hmm. And that definitely shows up in the plays, too. He's very sensitive to the ways that race is used to segment the working class and kind of pit people against each other.
Right. And it was so fascinating for me to go back and look at the way he describes characters in those plays, because there was not a movement at that time to really incorporate blacks and other minorities into the, you know, the great white way and the Broadway stage. And Manny was talking early on about black actors. And I found that so intriguing.
There's also, in a lot of the plays, there's discussions of anti-Semitism, and Fried was Jewish.
Yes.
Do you think his experience of anti-Semitism within the labor movement in some ways maybe made him more sensitive to looking at the plights of blacks and kind of other oppressed minorities?
Yeah, I do, and also women. The issue with women, to me, Andrew, is particularly interesting because in one of the early versions of this manuscript, I had submitted it to a publisher, and one of the critiques of the book was that the plays are really anti-women in many ways, and that's strange because Fried wasn't. Fried really was interested in enrolling women in the unions. And so I went back and I made some adjustments in the text to try to say, well, he was a man of his generation, blah, 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 blah. But I wasn't very happy with that. I think that Manny's record in minorities and women in the union is speaks for itself, and it's a good thing.
Yeah, one thing that, I mean, he's writing in the realist vein. I mean, these are not, you know, Brechtian agitprop pieces.
Absolutely.
They're really, you know, kind of grittily realistic. And you get that sense in a lot of the, there's a character in one of the plays who is a kind of a good union guy. And one of the kind of services he provides for the fellow workers is holding these annual stag parties where they invite a stripper to come in and perform for the guys. Which, you know, is not the kind of thing you'd see in a Clifford Odets play, but it's probably the kind of thing you'd actually see in a union in the 1940s.
That's right. That's right.
So he's not sugarcoating the reality that, you know, within the working class, there's plenty of misogyny and, you know, racism and religious bigotry.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you mentioned he's in the 30s trying to make it as an actor in New York, then becomes a director up in Buffalo. And then gets a job in a factory, becomes involved with union organizing.
Right.
At this point, did he think he was giving up the theater, or did he always plan to kind of be working as a union activist and also to continue his creative writing?
I think that at this point, he really was committed to the unions. I think he gave up the theater largely because I don't think he was as successful as he wanted to be in New York. And I think he also got married and had other obligations, and he committed himself almost full-time to being an organizer. His dreams about the theater, I don't know, performance-wise. You know, Manny acted many, many roles later in life with an adult company in Buffalo and was very well respected as an actor. But I think at some point he really did believe that he had found his niche as a union organizer.
Yeah, you mentioned his kind of late in life involvement in the theater in Buffalo, and he has kind of an amazingly long career. I mean, he's starting in the 30s and dies in, what, 2011 or something?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's performing with this a theater company, the Subversive Theater Collective, right? Like almost up until the end.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know if I mentioned this in our emails setting up the interview, but I actually first found out about Manny Fried. I'm a playwright, and I've written a couple of plays that deal with the labor movement, and
wow.
I did a reading of one of the plays, and you know, we did a little talk back afterwards, and somebody said, you know, I'm from Buffalo, and we used to have this playwright up there named Manny Fried. And, you know, I think he'd be happy to see that there were, you know, writers trying to continue that tradition.
Oh, wow. You know, one of the really frustrating things for me this summer is the book came out in May, but everything at the office, you know, in Southern Illinois, they're all working at home. And it's very difficult to get, you know, an advertising campaign going for this. But I did write to several people trying to find a voice in Buffalo. And I wrote to a couple of reporters at the Buffalo Daily News. I managed to find some names. And I've had absolutely no interest. I got this one reporter who eventually said, you know, the newspaper does not have... does not have a book review column. The arts person isn't really interested in the theater. And so there's this wonderful, just wonderful area that I could promote this book in Buffalo, but I can't find anybody to talk about it or write about it in Buffalo.
So the media blackout in Buffalo continues. Because that's something you talk about in the book is that, you know, I mean, we think of the Red Scare as, you know, we think of the people who were blacklisted in Hollywood and, you know, lost their career and the dramatic testimony before HUAC. But, you know, Manny Fried was not Elia Kazan. He was not kind of a household name even in his time. But he was just hounded for decades by the FBI and by the Catholic Church and by the local newspapers in Buffalo. I mean, the depth of the harassment, he had like a 3,000 page FBI file.
Right.
It's just incredible the ferocity with which the power structures kind of crack down on this guy. Like even going so far as to discourage people from eating at his wife's family's restaurant because they said every dollar you spend on a hamburger here is funding the communists. I mean, it's just incredible.
It was. It was amazing in terms of that period and how they destroyed people. And it's one of the passions that Manny has was to try to not let that be forgotten, to try to keep that on the, you know, above the fold and in the headlines. And he really did.
And that really that comes through in a lot of the plays, too, the ways that, you know, these issues of union organization are not just economic issues, but have really dramatic personal stakes. You know, I'm thinking of like the play The Dodo Bird, which just kind of depicts how this guy who had a sort of skilled job working with one of the complicated machines just, you know, loses that and has to kind of cobble together a living, and it just destroys him.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, the way that deindustrialization combined with the anti-communism really chewed up lives is kind of the theme of these plays.
Oh, absolutely. And what is so fascinating for me, as I say in the book, I try to look backward and forward. What is so fascinating to me is how many of these issues still resonate so passionately for us. Looking at yesterday's headline of the Seattle Times here, which says that basically it looks like Boeing is going to move their entire 787 plant out of Seattle and to South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there was a huge union battle there about working on the 787. I listened to our president and others constantly red baiting anyone that they don't like. As if, you know, Americans still buy into this idea that if you call someone a communist, you know, that will destroy them. And it's discouraging.
Even Joe Biden's not immune from red baiting, which is just incredible to me.
I know.
About the most right-wing, you know, elected official in the Democratic Party, and Trump's still saying he's a Trojan horse for socialism.
Right, like, right.
If only that were true.
Right, you know? I know, Andy.
So you also talk about Manny Fried's involvement in the UE union struggles of the late 40s. This was one of the largest and most radical unions, and it just got kind of carved up by inner union kind of fratricidal raiding. Can you talk a little bit about his involvement with that? And did that change his maybe rosy view of what it meant to be a union man?
You know, it's a fascinating question, because when you go back and you look at the history of that period and the people who really wanted to stay with the communist point of view, no matter what, you can understand why the union got split, because the whole notion of whether we should support Truman or not support Truman and give the election back to the Republicans was something that the communists really got criticized for in this country. They really wanted to hang on and go with their socialist man. They opposed the rebuilding of Europe. And it was a very bad time. Manny, I think, was an idealist. He held out. He really believed in the ideas of communism. But as I point out later on in that little short story that he wrote about being in Korea, I think that he knew, in spite of his denials, I think he knew the hatred in the face of Stalin. And I think that was a realization that he came to.
And in that story, he even has the narrator say, you know, if I were in Soviet Russia, maybe I would be in the gulags too, right?
Right, exactly.
Which is kind of an incredible admission.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So, I mean, he never really had, other than that late short story, he never really had a kind of dramatic moment of denouncing the party. Do you think that was partially because he always thought of himself more as a union organizer than a party organizer?
Yeah, absolutely. In some of the testimony that I quote, where he gets into a terrific arguments with Communist Party representatives, and he keeps insisting, I'm a labor organizer first, not a party organizer. And that distinction meant a lot to Manny. The difference between organizing for the party and organizing for the union. Manny was a union person, first and foremost. And the communists, you know, hated when he got out of line.
So he was not above kind of deviating from the party line.
No, no. But he never renounced the party. That's very true.
Yeah.
And I think...
There are a couple of people prominent communists who never really... Like, I think Pete Seeger left the party in, like, 1991 or something.
Right, exactly. Right.
Like, maybe a little later than would be appropriate, but, you know.
Right. And,
So this is in the context of the CIO's decision to purge communists from leadership. And in one of the plays, he discusses the role of the Catholic Church in encouraging this red baiting within the labor movement and kind of purging leftists and communists from leadership roles. Could you kind of describe those events in his life and kind of how they show up in the plays?
Yeah, Manny was very intrigued by the fact that the Catholic Church really had such power in the working class. And he felt that once the Catholic trade unions had really decided to red bait people and go on the attack against communism, he felt that that was going to be a very, very difficult period for organized labor. I was intrigued by his relationship with some of the hierarchy in the Catholic Church in Buffalo, because they really did dislike him, and they really felt that the unions were going to be sold out, you know, to the communists. And on top of that, he had this personal relationship with his wife, who had this business, and, you know, the Catholic leaders tried to denounce her, and it became very, very complicated. But I think that Manny's bottom line was that there was a trilogy that was formed in this country between the church and the state and the business organizations to demonize labor at all costs. He also recognized that labor was not pure. He recognized the futility of trying to support labor when they were using union dues to buy casinos. but he also felt that you should not demonize organized labor because it's the last bulwark we have against a kind of vulture capitalism.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And that's certainly been borne out in the last, say, 40 years.
Yes, it has.
As the union movement has declined and there's just been exploding inequality.
Absolutely. And the way that the teachers' unions are red-baited is really impossible to understand.
You write about Fried's testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee, which he testified in front of them twice in 54 right. and 64.
Right.
I didn't realize that that TUOC was around in 64. I mean, that's much later than I feel like we normally think of that as
yeah,
being.
They were still going strong and still finding ways to investigate party members. The 64 event where he testified, and his testimony there is wonderful because it's absolutely explosive. But that was also caught up with some friends of his, some professors who were being investigated at the Buffalo State University. And the whole idea that HUAC had kind of moved along from, you know, Hollywood stars to political stars to teachers and college professors was something that Manny was very aware of, and aware of how HUAC could continue to sow their poison. And I think that's why he was so outraged in 64.
And he didn't take the fifth, right?
No, he didn't.
So what did he say when he was called in front of HUAC? What was his defense?
The first time he just said, you know, I'm not going to take the fifth. You have no business. You have no legality. You have no legal basis to ask me these questions. And he knew that by taking that stand, because some people had, by taking that stand, he could be in contempt of Congress. And for some reason, and he doesn't know why, and I don't know why, either he was too loquacious or he was too stubborn, but they chose not to do what they had done to Arthur Miller and other people who had also taken that stance.
It's so fascinating to me the different ways that different theater artists dealt with the House Un-American Activities Committee. It feels like for each one, it became a type of a performance. So, you know, Manny Fried has this very impassioned, you know, very earnest defense. And, you know, someone like Brecht just keeps saying, oh, you know, you're really misrepresenting me because that's a terrible translation. If you'd only had the right translation, you would see that I didn't say anything like that. You know?
Right, right. I've always loved Lillian Hellman, in spite of the controversy. I've always loved Lillian Hellman's response when people would say, well, you should have done this, or you should have done that, or people should have done that. Lillian Hellman used to say, hey, you didn't get the subpoena.
Mm.
Don't tell me what you would have done. You didn't get the subpoena.
Yeah. So, moving from maybe one meaning of the term political theater to another, what was Fried's relationship to kind of mainstream theater of the day, and when did he start to get his plays produced?
His play, he's a I forget his agent's name. She was a prominent agent. She sent his plays out to several Broadway producers. Frequently, they would just come back as not commercial. And not commercial meant either too political or too big a cast or whatever. He began to have some success with his plays in the 60s, began to get some productions. The one that I talk about in California was a very successful production. The Dodo Bird did get some regard off-Broadway. But by and large, I think the combination of the FBI constantly haunting him and the notion that frequently his plays were not commercial in a mainstream way really prevented him from having them seen. And that was one of the things that I was interested in writing this book, is that there's no way you're going to see a lot of these plays. I mean, we're in an era now of, you know, one person shows and six casts no matter what. But I thought that they should be preserved because I think they are a kind of living record and a cultural record of a whole part of our country that's very important.
And he had some later in his life productions as well. I mean, I forget which play, but one of them was produced at Subversive Theater in the mid-2000s,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, yes. I tried to get in touch with those folks at Subversive Theater, and I haven't been able to. I think that they're on, you know, some kind of shutdown like we all are in many senses.
Yeah.
So I've tried to get in touch with them, but I haven't.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of the whole theater world is on a pause right now, and it's very
right.
uncertain when things are going to be able to reopen. Freed is not unique among American playwrights in that he had sympathy with unionized labor, but he is somewhat unique in that he actually had, you know, decades of experience in the labor movement. So what do you see separating his plays from, you know, a play like, I don't know, A View from the Bridge, perhaps, that depicts working class characters, but from the perspective of somebody who either wasn't ever in the working class or had long since left the working class?
Yeah, that's hard because, you know, he really believed that his plays, or he really wanted to try to capture in his plays the ebb and flow, the real time, the real character, the real lifestyle of people in the working class. But he was not the dramatist that Miller was, or Odets was, or a variety of other people who wrote about the working class. He felt he could write about the working class from inside out. And he did. But frequently, the issues that get propelled out of his plays are not as powerful as something like A View from the Bridge, for example.
The plays often kind of center around really the minutiae of organizing within a union.
I mean, absolutely, absolutely.
You almost want to reach for a glossary or something to understand even just kind of what's going on a plot level.
Oh, absolutely. And the whole notion that he goes into such detail about how these meetings were held and how they were organized, and the detail about, you know, how they established the pyramid in the committee room or in the meeting room in order to silence the opposition. You know, a lot of that is really powerful information, but it does tend, as you say, to devolve into minutiae in a number of places.
Right, and you know, it's not like it's without stakes. I mean, when they're using kind of obscure points of Robert's rules to kind of silence one another, there's real kind of heft behind that. But it could just get a little lost in, wait, why is this person speaking out of turn right now? Why is
right.
this person allowed to introduce this motion at this time? You know,
right.
You definitely get the sense that he understands what those meetings were like. But,
yes. And without being able to see them on the page, it can become very confusing.
Yeah.
So
I saw on a television show a depiction of a meeting of a left-wing political group where the meeting was just them standing up and yelling slogans.
Yes.
Like it, and it's like, oh, you've never been in that room. And you don't get that sense with these plays at all. You feel like, oh, you know this stuff to your bones.
Right, right. Although it's very clear the way the fascists and the communists get delineated in Manny's world.
Yes. Yeah, and he, and you know, in Elegy for Stanley Gorski, he has the narrator character kind of poking fun at the use of these very reductive slogans. But you also get the sense, he does sort of believe that, you know, the Catholic Church is behaving like fascists.
Right, right.
In these disputes.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that was so intriguing to me, Manny's depiction of how the labor priests actually functioned. You know, mm-hmm. and I couldn't help but think of Karl Malden and On the Waterfront, where he is portrayed in such heroic terms. And
saintly, yeah.
Yeah, saintly terms. And for Manny, that was not the labor priests, who were a formidable force at one point in the church.
Yeah, there's a character in one of the, I think it's in Elegy for Stanley Gorski, says the labor movement is too important to be in the hands of anybody but the Catholic Church.
Right, right. It's too important to be in anyone else's hands but ours.
Yep. Yeah. So certainly, you know, it's a less sunny view of kind of the labor priest phenomenon.
Yeah.
So one other thing that I think sets his plays apart from the plays of Clifford Odets or you know, the Federal Theater Project is that the majority of them were not written at the kind of peak of struggle in the 30s and 40s. They're really kind of documents of the long, slow decline of the labor movement from the 60s to the 80s. How do you feel that sets them apart, you know, tonally, artistically, from those earlier labor plays?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. He's always kind of looking back in his plays. And one of the things that intrigued me, especially visiting the sites there in Buffalo, one of the things that intrigued me was that Manny really felt that what was happening in the labor movement had its roots, you know, back in the 30s and had its roots in the Taft-Hartley organization and other things. But he really felt that as he looked back, he could see how things kept developing. And he could see how the unions continued to be demonized. And so I think that the plays are very reflective in a way, because he has a longer view than the folks who were actually writing at the moment. And I think that he, you know, when he talks about in the Dodo Bird and others about the deindustrialization of America, he's talking from the point where he already sees it. I was just haunted by the place in there. I forget who I was quoting, but he talks about, you know, people who criticize this, have they ever lived in Chicago at night? Have they ever heard the gunfire? You know, do they know what's going on in the inner cities? And I think Manny's whole interest in the labor movement was the way that he could see it in a long arc. And he felt that one of the tremendous moments was, you know, when Reagan destroyed the airline union.
Right. And as a Marxist, you know, you really see the vision that he has of what happens to organized labor, what happens to the working class is sort of the canary in the coal mine for what's going to happen to the whole country. That's the base that determines the superstructure of culture and society as a whole.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, that play Dodo Bird especially is just so brutal. I mean, could you talk about that play? That play is very different than the other two, than Drop Hammer and Elegy for Stanley Gorski. It's got only four characters, and it's a bartender, this guy named the Dodo Bird, who's this sort of pathetic alcoholic, though, you know, he becomes more sympathetic as the play goes on. And then there's kind of a almost like an angel and a devil who who are kind of trying to see, is he going to fall back into drink, or is he going to stay sober to meet his estranged daughter? Could you talk a bit about that play? I mean, was this, it seems like a bizarre question with such a dark play, but was this kind of his bid for making something a little bit more acceptable to the demands of the commercial theater?
I think it may have been, yeah. The intriguing thing about the Dodo Bird is that, again, the labor issues are there, and they're central. And while we tend to get caught up in the Dodo Bird's alcoholism and the incredible loss of his daughter and his wife, I mean, it's just a horrible story. But what's playing underneath in the, you know, those other two guys is resentment over things that have happened in the union. And I've forgotten now exactly what the point is, but what's driving Bull is not just his dislike for the Dodo. What's driving him also is the way that he feels he wasn't appreciated or he wasn't applauded for some things that he did in the union. Whereas the other guy says these things were outrageous. And so between them, it's not only about the Dodo Bird, it's about union politics, which always comes back in Fried's work.
So I have a question about the relationship of the plays to the kind of extraordinary repression that he faced. Did the FBI, do you think the fact that he was writing these plays was part of the reason the FBI was so interested in him, or do you think they were really just interested in him as a kind of radical labor organizer?
Oh, I think that, yeah, I think they were interested in him early on because he was a member of the Communist Party. They knew that early on. And I think that was that was the place where they were. That's the place where Hoover was. If you remember the Communist Party, then you deserved anything they could do to you. I think that Manny's plays and his work and all of that, you know, maybe was not the chief concern that they were doing. The party just wanted to keep him unemployed. They wanted to keep him followed. They wanted to intimidate him and his neighbors and his family. And it's part of just a very sad chapter in this country in terms of the way Hoover was able to do that. But I think that Manny's plays probably suffered from the fact that every time a producer would be interested, a producer would be visited. And every time it looked like something nice might happen, it didn't. I think a lot of those incidents maybe were his own paranoia. I don't resist that for a moment. When you have been followed by the FBI most of your adult life, it's hard not to be paranoid about it.
It reminds me of that line from the Nirvana song, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not after you.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to talk about that because I, when I was reading the book, I was kind of going back and forth and kind of being like, you know, he's blaming his persecution on his lack of success as a playwright. And, you know, the plays are certainly extraordinary in a lot of ways, but I could understand why if you were a producer, you would say, there's no way we're producing this play that has 30 characters arguing about, you know, union dues.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, that question of is he paranoid and kind of blaming it? But then when he does finally get hold of his FBI file, it's thousands of pages.
Yes,
and it just reveals that they have been tailing him. I mean, this must have been, you know, some agent's, you know, life's work, essentially, to tail this poor guy and to harass his friends and family for 40 years.
Yes, well, there were two agents that he identified later on in the lawsuit, and both of them eventually died before that lawsuit got settled. But he had pretty clear evidence that these two guys had just hounded him and his neighbors.
Right.
You know, and then when I talked to the daughters, excuse me, when I talked to Lori and Mindy, and their election, you know, their recollections of what it was like to live in this time are just so sad. You know, when they begin to realize that the carpool that was going to take her to the temple, she's no longer welcome. When kids say stuff to her, you know, on the school ground about commies, what was it like for these two little girls, you know, to suddenly see their father on the front pages of the paper, demonized? And that's where I really found this part of this story so interesting. Both those girls are still alive. Mindy has written a lovely memoir of her dad. Let's see if I know. Called Caring for Red by Mindy Freed, A Daughter's Memoir. And in it gives a lot of the feeling of growing up with this struggle.
Yeah, do they express kind of regret that her father was involved in left-wing politics? Or I mean, there's a great evocation in Gornick's book about, you know, the very intense relationship, emotional relationships between daughters and their communist fathers. I mean, did he kind of remain a hero for his daughters?
I think so. Yeah, he certainly is today for them both. I think that, well, Mindy, you know, who's written this this lovely Caring for Red memoir, Mindy became very politically active herself, and Lori was intensely devoted to her dad. You know, they supported him at these hearings. They really believed that he was right. The only thing that they ever said to me in one of the phone interviews was that they said, you know, Barry, I'm sure there was a time when we thought, you know, maybe Dad's plays aren't that good. maybe it isn't the FBI.
Right.
But no, they were absolutely devoted to their dad and still are.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you know, without putting too fine a point on it, it's really incredible that in their pursuit of communists, of American citizens who are members of the Communist Party or fellow travelers, the FBI really ended up reproducing the tactics of the Stalinist secret police.
Yeah, oh, I know. It's absolutely amazing. And, you know, there are some wonderful books out there about it, but they don't get much press. They don't get read very much. And I've forgotten one of the books that really impressed me in terms of the way that this fellow described how the party went after people. And
you mean how the Bureau, the FBI,
I'm
went
sorry,
after people?
I'm sorry, yeah. Yes, how the Bureau went after people. And you know, it was no holes barred. It was, you know, when COINTELPRO came in, you know, we're going to get rid of them. You know, we badmouthed them. Now we're going to just get rid of them. We're going to go to the neighbors. Manny's picture was in the paper. Red baited constantly.
It seems like with Trump, everybody is so eager to find kind of non-American authoritarians to compare him to. But there's certainly plenty of authoritarianism in our own history that we could see that. I mean, his mentor was Roy Cohn, who's exactly. One of the prominent figures in McCarthyism.
Exactly. Exactly.
So it definitely seems like there's a direct line between what was going on at this period and some of the authoritarianism we see today.
Oh, absolutely. The whole notion of Roy Cohn being brought back somehow in a gentler, softer light by an administration is just appalling.
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that Roy Cohn is relevant to something other than a character in Angels in America is depressing.
Know. Yes, it is.
Speaking of things that are a little less depressing, you talk a little bit about Lynn Nottage's play Sweat, which was a big hit on Broadway, won the Pulitzer Prize, and deals with, you know, it's a very Manny Fried-like situation. I don't know if there's a specific influence there or if it's just sort of inevitable given the subject matter, but
right.
That's a play that takes place primarily in a bar near a factory during deindustrialization and deals with the way that those tensions between of race and gender get tied up with the class conflict. Do you feel like the success of this play indicates that perhaps the theater is becoming a little bit more open to working class concerns?
No, I think there are voices from time to time that speak out and get noticed for whatever reason. I mean, I think that Sweat is an intriguing play. I think that unlike Manny, you know, Manny's plays, you don't see or you see in Sweat the devastation more in terms of the drug problems,
mm-hmm.
or the violence. But I think that the parameters of it are very, very like what Manny was talking about. And the whole idea that organized labor is still demonized.
You definitely get much less of the kind of inner politics of the union in Sweat.
Yeah, absolutely.
There aren't those operatic, union hall scenes as much.
Right, right. And Sweat, you know, is in many senses the well-made play. You want to find out what happened. What was the violence? What happened to the bartender? I forgot now. When I saw it in New York, there was I was anticipating the big jolt at the end, and I didn't really feel the big jolt as much as I wanted to when I was trying to figure out what the big jolt was. But it's a fascinating play. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I think it's a really good play. I went to see it with a friend of mine, and he left the theater, and he was just sort of looked dazed. And I was like, what's up, man? And he just goes, the system.
Yeah.
Which I thought that was a pretty good summary. And then finally, so Manny Fried didn't live to see the two Sanders campaigns, ultimately unsuccessful.
Wow.
But,
yeah.
You know, in the years since he's died, it hasn't even been 10 years, but socialism is really back on the map as a serious kind of current in American politics.
Right.
Do you have any sense of kind of what he would think about this?
Wow, that's a good question, Andy. I'm not, you know, Manny was always so good at looking beneath the headlines and beyond the headlines and to the actual workings of what was going on. And he didn't get tempted by a lot of the niceties. The whole current debate about socialism, he would, of course, been unhappy with the way it's being demonized. But I don't know how he'd respond to, you know, the kind of the uplift, the kind of, look, this is good socialism. We have Social Security. We have this. We have that. Mm. Look at Sweden. I mean, the multiple ways that socialism has not been demonized, I think Manny would admire, but I think also he would be very suspicious of the way that we're red-baiting once again, no matter what.
Yeah, maybe he would be more excited about the recent strike waves than about any kind of electoral.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show to talk about this book. I really enjoyed getting to know this this playwright, Manny Fried, and I hope your book will introduce a wider readership to his plays, because they're certainly a strange beast, but I think a really vital voice in the American theater.
Wow. Thank you, Andy. I appreciate your interest very much.